Welcome to Pacifica Radio's national coverage of the New Hampshire primary, coming to you live from the studios of KPFK Radio in Los Angeles. I'm Ian Masters, host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com, and I'll be your host for this hour, the first of 3 hours of national coverage on this historic night. And tonight we'll be covering the New Hampshire primaries as the results come in live on the Pacifica Radio Network. Most of the polls closed an hour ago, but many in the big urban areas of New Hampshire just now closed at 8 p.m. Eastern. So we'll be examining the results and assessing their implications for the crowded field of Republican candidates that is expected to be winnowed a little after tonight, as well as how the two Democratic candidates were judged by the voters of New Hampshire in this first of the nation's 2016 primaries. Joining us tonight to offer a critical overview of the place where these candidates hope to end up living at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in January of 2017, that broken, polarized, and gridlocked capital, otherwise known as Nigeria on the Potomac, is a 28-year veteran senior congressional staffer, Mike Lofgren, the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. He will guide us through the Republican trumpeting and trampling of elephants to find out which clowns have been dropped from the caravan as the circus leaves town on its way to Nevada and South Carolina. Then also on the panel, we have Adele Stan, a columnist for The American Prospect, who will handicap Hillary as this second of largely white states vote ahead of the next two, where minority voters will have their say. Also on tonight's panel is Jacob Heilbrun, a senior editor at The National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. And while this is a local election for us, for the rest of the world, it is a global election, and Jacob will assess the foreign policy implications in terms of who is leading on both sides, and in particular, the fortunes of Marco Rubio, who, if elected, will revive the neocons' disastrous foreign policy and likely lead us into as many wars as the neocons and Sheldon Adelson can find. And last but not least, we have Jedediah Purdy, a professor of law at Duke University, whose most recent book is A Tolerable Anarchy. He is a supporter of Bernie Sanders, and we will look ahead to whether this insurgent socialist candidate is on his way to the White House or on his way to building a national movement or both. And I guess in terms of ladies first, Adele Stan, are you with us?
I am. Great to be here, Ian.
Thank you, Adele. And of course, Adele is a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics and is currently a weekly columnist for The American Prospect. And Jedediah Purdy, are you with us?
I am, Ian. I'm glad to be here. Hey, Adele.
Hey, Jed.
And Jedediah Purdy is a professor of law at Duke University, where he focuses on constitutional, environmental, and property law. He has been a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, an ethics fellow at Harvard University, and a visiting professor at Yale Law School and Harvard Law School. And he is the author, most recently, of A Tolerable Anarchy. And Mike Lofgren, are you with us?
I sure am. Good to be here.
Thank you, Mike. And Mike has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina, disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book just out is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of the Shadow Government. And Jacob Heilbrun, are you with us?
I am, Ian, also from Washington.
Otherwise known as Nigeria on the Potomac. Jacob is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the LA Times, a senior editor of the New Republic, and a Japan Society Fellow. His latest article at the National Interest is, Does Rubio Know What He Is Doing? So let's start with you, Mike, since you know the town in which they all want to end up on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. You have a pretty jaundiced view of the whole thing. What's the latest that you're hearing, and who do you think is going to come out on top on both the Republican and Democratic side?
Well, obviously, Trump and Sanders. But, I must give a disclaimer here. I worked for Congressman John Kasich, now governor of Ohio. I haven't worked for him for 16 years, and it
really, we haven't had any contact in about a decade, but he appears to be, if coming in second means you're the winner, according to the expectations game, he is the winner.
Well, Marco Rubio came in third, and he thought he was the winner. What do you think, Jacob, in terms of Marco Rubio's fortunes?
Very unclear. I mean, obviously he was on the upswing in after Iowa, but the fundamental point that keeps getting rammed home is how mediocre most of these candidates really are on the Republican side. And I think, you know, the flimsiness of Rubio became patent in New Hampshire. But I don't think it's confined to him. But, you know, the Republicans keep looking for that establishment figure, and they keep wilting.
Well, as I mentioned, it may be a local election for us, but it's a global election for the rest of the world, and they are literally holding their breath. The rest of the world seems to be absolutely in dismay at the people that are running for president of the United States, the lone superpower that dominates the globe. Jedediah, what's your sense of, I know you're a Bernie supporter, and where's he stand now? I take it he's the polls have given him a 20-point lead, between 20 and 9 points. He appears to be around 60%, and Hillary Clinton at 41%, 57.5% with 9% of the vote in for Sanders, 41.3% for Clinton.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, as far as this sort of silly but inescapable expectations game goes, people seem to have felt that if Clinton could get the margin down into single digits, the difference between the two, that would mean that these guns the Clinton campaign has brought out against Bernie in the last couple of weeks, particularly this steady drumbeat that this is not a realistic candidacy, that voting for Sanders is punching a ticket to a Cruz candidacy, that it's letting your heart beat out your head in a season when the head has to be in charge. A close margin would have suggested that campaign was taking hold, as well as they're releasing a bunch of proxies to criticize Sanders' judgment and character and so on, from Bill Clinton on down. So the big numbers are obviously hopeful, and they are a test of the first moment when the Clinton campaign has really gone hard against Sanders now that they don't think winning is inevitable.
Well, ABC News, of course, have already called the election for both Sanders and Trump. That should be no surprise, I guess, in as much as this time the polls appear to be pretty accurate, at least with 9% of the vote in now. Adele, is there any fallout from the battle between the intramural battle between older and younger feminists?
Wow. Start me with an easy question. Yeah, this, you know, what I've been really pondering was the whole election, both on the Democratic and the Republican sides, is that this whole election seems to be about women, even though there's very little talk of their actual rights or prospects, you know. You know, on Trump's on the Republican side, where you have Trump with this enormous lead, I mean, it's really misogyny that drives his campaign more than any other of the, you know, lengthy list of resentments on which his campaign is built. And then when you go to the Democratic side, there is really a very raw, exposed nerve right now in feminism over what this divide between the generations that it seems to be apparent in the New Hampshire primary in particular means for feminism. So, you know, it's I think the narrative coming out of New Hampshire outside of the horse race really is about the future of feminism and what do young women want.
And do you think that as much as you've suggested that the issues about women are not about what should be talked about, is there any chance that there'll be something further down the pike that'll be a little more serious? I know, as I mentioned in the opening, White America is voting in both Iowa and New Hampshire. We've yet to hear from African Americans and Latinos, Asian Americans, etc. We will start to hear from them on the 20th in right. Nevada, and I think, was it the 29th in or 26th in South Carolina?
Yes. Well, we do know that if you know, according to national polling right now, Hillary Clinton is winning among young African American women, but winning by a smaller margin, a far smaller margin than if you just look at the racial breakdown between you know, the two candidates, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. You know, I think she's winning young African American women by like 4%. Now, national polling at this point in the game can be, you know, can be almost meaningless. So it does remain to be seen how that all breaks down. But certainly among white millennials, Bernie Sanders seems to really have, you know, ignited a generation, and that includes, you know, white millennial women. And, you know, these are folks who, and I don't mean for this to sound condescending, it's just a point of fact of history, is that, you know, these are folks who, you know, were born in the post-Roe world. Now, what's really dismaying is that in the Democratic debate, in the most recent Democratic debate, you know, following a year when states passed 57 laws, anti-choice laws throughout the nation, in which three people were killed at a Planned Parenthood clinic, that choice wasn't even raised as an issue in the Democratic, in the last Democratic debate. So while you have this whole the kind of narrative the media love, you know, so they can couch a generational divide between women as something as of a cat fight, you don't have women's actual issues being discussed.
So let me turn to Mike Lofgren, since he mentioned he'd worked for John Kasich on the Hill. He seems to be the surprise on the Republican side. With 7% reporting, Trump's at 33.5 and Kasich's at 16.8. So it looks as though his votes have been somewhat at the expense of the others following him, which are Bush, Cruz, and Rubio.
Well, in some ways, that's explainable, because most people don't really focus on the fact that Iowa is not really that different from New Hampshire for the Democrats. For instance, the winner of the Iowa caucuses in 2004, 2008, became the nominee. But it's a different ball game in Iowa. Kasich was nowhere there. He didn't really compete. You had Cruz winning, but then you had Huckabee winning in 2008, Santorum in 2012. You could go all the way back to 1988, and you have Pat Robertson doing very well there. So it's a different group. So I expected Kasich to do better. Cruz, possibly Rubio, certainly Ben Carson were concentrating on, you know, the 60% of Republicans who identify as evangelicals in Iowa, whereas in New Hampshire only 25% do. And, you know, let's look at the facts. When you look at the Republican menagerie there, I mean, you've got Trump, you've got Carson, you've got all these people. You've got a really nasty character who was sort of revealing himself in the last debate with Christie. Jeb Bush wouldn't be in that race if his name was Jeb Smith. So So Kasich at least has a record that goes back, you know, to the early 80s, and he's also not a knee-jerk interventionist. He was against the Balkan War. He considered it a drive-by shooting with cruise missiles for no discernible national interest, and he was against the intervention in Lebanon in 1983, and after the Beirut barracks bombing, he was vindicated on that. Now, certainly for an independent or liberal audience, what he did in Ohio with trying to roll back labor protections for state employees, they would see that as too extreme. And in fact, the Ohio voters overwhelmingly defeated it in a referendum. But when you look at the crew you've got with people like Carly Fiorina and Ben Carson, for crying out loud, he comes across like John Quincy Adams.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Pacificus Radio live coverage of the New Hampshire primary. So let me ask Jacob Heilbrun, in terms of the loser so far, and of course everybody, ABC News, New York Times, AP, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, they're all calling the races already for both contests for Sanders on the Democratic side and Trump on the Republican side. But the one person who seems to be disappearing is Governor Christie, who really did go out of his way to do a hit job on Rubio. And Rubio is now coming in behind Cruz, Bush, and Kasich and Trump in fifth place. But it doesn't look like maybe the message got across, but the messenger didn't do too well.
Well, maybe he did, though. He will be rewarded if there is a Republican president. He could be attorney general.
That's true, as long as it's not Rubio.
I think Christie knew that he was on the – I think knew he was on the ropes, and basically he was deputed to take out Rubio. And what Mike was saying about Kasich actually makes a lot of sense if you think about the race. On the Republican side, he is actually the most anti-Trump of all the candidates. So in a way, it would make sense for – more mainstream Republicans to gravitate towards him. Though I always thought he lacked the charisma to make it. But, Cruz and Trump are competing in the same lane, and Rubio is no establishment candidate. I mean, in some ways, the media has contorted these candidates. Rubio is not a moderate. He's not a moderate on social issues in any way or form. I would consider him to be one of the extremists in the race.
Well, he certainly, in terms of the abortion issue, he has no exceptions for rape and incest.
No. I mean, it's
that's pretty extreme. Nuts. So, in terms of then going forward, is there a path for Bush? I mean, he's coming in third, roughly, but he's still a bit of a non-event. There's an expectation that he'll do well in the South, as there is with Cruz. So what kind of a bump are they going to get, assuming that the figures stay as they are, with Trump followed by Kasich, Bush, Cruz, Rubio, and the others are heading for the scrap heap?
I'm not optimistic about Bush's fortunes, because if you look at George W. Bush, you know, he swung to the right and vilified McCain. in South Carolina, and I don't see Jeb going down that road or even being able to pull it off convincingly. I think what you're witnessing is the fall of the House of Bush, but maybe what we're witnessing at the same time is the fall of the Clintons too. I mean, it may be that both of those political brands are shot.
Well, that's probably music to your ears, Jedediah Purdy. Do you obviously, having the race called now for Sanders and Trump, Sanders, if he comes in around 60 or below, I guess Clinton was really hoping she could hold him down to at least single digits in his, terms of his lead. And that's where it is, I guess. That's not where it is at the moment. So there is this thing they used to call the big momentum. Do you expect that after tonight, the national press is going to really start taking Bernie Sanders seriously?
That's hard to say. I think in some sense, people have swung to taking him seriously in a way they hadn't before, in the sense of putting him under tougher scrutiny and beginning to pose questions like what sort of candidate would he be in the general were he to take the nomination. And I think it might make sense for us actually to leapfrog the horse race and the media expectations mirror game a little bit and try to think about the case for his plausibility as a general election candidate and see how that holds up. His energy and turnout are pretty extraordinary so far. They've been compared in Iowa somewhat unfavorably to the Obama turnout in 2008. And it's true that somewhat fewer Democrats showed up at the caucuses, and Obama brought out a huge number in 08. But if the relevant comparator is not Obama 08, but Clinton 16, it does seem that there's this tremendous youthful energy around Sanders, which counts for something. It was part of the way that Obama mobilized and kept a coalition that depended very intensely on turnout and on canvassing mobilization all through 2008 and then again 2012. And I think it's significant that although it's easy to say that Iowa and New Hampshire are both welcoming states for Sanders, that they didn't look that way a year ago at all. He's come from way, way behind in both states and was really, until sometime in the late fall, almost universally regarded as a kind of token protest candidate. So in places where voters have thought hard about the primary and really being confronted with the candidates, Sanders has launched extraordinary come-from-behind wins. And it's the conventional thing that's said is that he faces two limits on that kind of expansion, right? One of them is ideological, because we have something like just north of 50% of voters saying in one of these recent, not very meaningful polls that they'd never vote for a socialist. And then the demographic worry that, as you said, Ian's quite right, so far it's a certain segment of white America that's voted. I think the ideological challenge is one that we should be wary of taking too seriously, because the term socialist is suddenly a kind of wide open one in the meaning it can have. I think we see that in both the number of young voters who say that they have a favorable view of socialism and the number of Iowa Democratic voters who said that they self-identified as socialist. I think what this means is that the term suddenly has a very broad range of potential significance, including something like an FDR-style Democratic platform, which is essentially what Sanders is running on. And as for the people who say they'd never vote for a socialist, I think at least half or two or three quarters of those are anti-Obama voters who have been told by Fox News that socialist means Obama. So they're saying, in a sense, I'd never vote for that Obama. I think we shouldn't overestimate, or we shouldn't be sure that we know the significance of Sanders' name for himself yet. And then as for the last point, it's not trivial that most of the people who have voted for Sanders have been white. But, of course, they're in Iowa and New Hampshire, and they can't help it in a sense. So I do find it a little condescending when Clinton proxies or just very conventional analysts, and I haven't heard anything like this tonight, for example, assume that the Clintons have a kind of deep felt loyalty among African-American voters in places like South Carolina. I think we'll just see once voters in those primaries start taking a good look at the candidates. And I think one thing they will see is that although Sanders has not been in certain ways attuned to the African-American electorate in the way the Clintons have, he has been deeply concerned with structural issues of justice, from the economy to the criminal justice system, for a very long time, and recognized that movements like Black Lives Matter are really about structural injustice, and that there's a deep kind of commonality between what he's calling for and the injustices that those movements are responding to. So in all of these ways, I think in this extraordinary and unusual year, there are reasons at the very least to assume some humility about what's possible this time around.
Well, now that the S word is out of the closet, let me ask, and by the way, that it doesn't to seem as though there's a lot to report here in terms of surprises. Again, it's pretty clear that Bernie Sanders has won and on the Democratic side, and Donald Trump has won on the Republican side with roughly 14% of the vote in now. Sanders is at 56.3%, Clinton at 41.6% on the Republican side, with 12.3% reporting. Trump's at 34.2%, followed by Kasich at 15.9%, Bush at 11.9%, Cruz at 11.2%, Rubio at 9.7%, and Christie at 7.8%. At least the good news for us in terms of an audience is that we won't have to deal with some of the – I don't imagine they're going to keep the kids' table going and have these other people join it. So there's a small mercy there. So why don't we all sort of talk amongst ourselves rather than me keep going around the table here, because I'm sure each of you have questions for each other and have things to say. So go ahead, Adele.
Well, you know, I'd like to respond to some of the things that Jedediah Purdy just said. I do agree entirely that the notion of the word socialist as an out-and-out pejorative is really, I think, dissipating thanks to the Bernie Sanders campaign. And it has long been a dirty little truth of, and I say dirty ironically, of American public opinion sentiment that many of the positions that the American people actually hold are socialist in nature. But they just would not apply that label to it, you know, whether it's support for Social Security or single-payer health care even, that, you know, the sentiment of the average American voter is far more socialist than people would like to admit. In terms of, while I concur that, you know, Bernie Sanders' critique is a structural one of the structure of the economy and its quote-unquote riggedness, which is extremely valuable. And I think it was really been, I think it up until this point, the Sanders candidacy is a real plus for the Democratic Party in correcting its, waft towards corporatism. I don't know that it really the part where I have really felt that Sanders is tone deaf is in not addressing the way inequalities within social classes work. And, you know, there's a real argument to be made that until you have equality for women, with more than lip service to the pay gap but real equality, which includes, you know, a woman's bodily integrity, you really can't fix these larger structural issues within the economy, because that's a huge structural issue. I mean, you know, global research has shown when women do better, the whole society fares better in terms of those kinds of economic measures. So I do think that you know, there's a certain tone deafness that Sanders has on these issues of race and gender that I don't know how that will work, you know, beyond New Hampshire. I mean, he was expected to win New Hampshire because, you know, he's something of a favorite son. It's what was said of Romney, you know, 4 years ago, having been a Massachusetts governor. Now, Sanders is doing quite well, and this is not to say he's not giving Clinton a real run for her money. But I do think it remains to be seen how it all plays out. And the one last thing I would say about Sanders' viability as a general election candidate is that the one thing one can say about Hillary Clinton is that she really has a very clear sense of the right wing and how it works and how it would work against her in a general election, I think. And the full, you know, I got to remember, the Kochs have not been in this primary race in a real way. The full force of the Koch machine will be out in the general election. Do I know how that would all play out? No, but I do think that that's also got to be factored in when assessing the prowess of either of those candidates in a general election.
So both Mike and Jacob.
I'd like to jump in there just as an outsider.
Mike Lofgren.
You know, I'm an independent now, but what I find intriguing is this sort of notion of squabbles among Democrats over the meaning of words like socialist. Because
progressive,
when you let people define you, and the Republican Fox News media entertainment complex has been doing this for 20 years, defining liberal as a dirty word. So they dumped that one totally overboard, and now they're progressives. And now Bernie Sanders comes along and describes himself as a democratic socialist. And, oh, now we've got to worry about, you know, people who say they'll never vote for a socialist, regardless of whether they think it's Olaf Palme or Joe Stalin. But an interesting thing, an ABC exit poll, nearly 7 in 10 voters in the Democratic primary describe themselves as liberals, including a quarter who say they're very liberal. So what gets me is the way Democratic office holders run away from that term rather than simply throwing it back in their faces. Frank Luntz is not invincible.
Right. Well, of course, Republicans routinely say I'm a proud conservative. It got so crazy that Romney said I'm a severe conservative, but liberals never stand up and say I'm a proud liberal. There's obviously a great deficit there. Jacob Harbin, given that these two outsiders are winning, Trump and Bernie, in terms of foreign policy, in terms of establishment politics, what's the foreign policy landscape looking like ahead here? And also, I'd like to have Mike weigh in on this too, since he's written about the deep state, the complaint being with the deep state being that the reason there's no difference between George W. Bush's foreign policy and Barack Obama's is that the deep state controls foreign policy. So starting with you, Jacob, what's your sense?
Well, if I were advising the Sanders campaign, which I'm not, because I actually think Hillary is going to win the nomination, but he should be pounding her on foreign policy, because one of the chief criticisms against Sanders is that he's not up to speed on foreign policy. But he would be better off saying that, in fact, it is precisely Hillary's record that disqualifies her to be commander-in-chief because of her hawkishness. On the Republican side, Trump, to some degree, Cruz and maybe Kasich, but I doubt it. But I see more Trump and Cruz as candidates who are trying to jettison the neoconservative Bush-Cheney legacy in the Republican Party. Trump is militaristic, but he seems to be much more confined in his port scorn on the idea of democratization abroad, nation building, and Cruz attacked the Clinton and Clinton's endorsement of the war in Libya. So I think there is a debate in the Republican Party, but interestingly, you haven't seen much of one among the Democrats.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Pacificus Radio live coverage of the New Hampshire primary. Mike Lufkin, in terms of the deep state, not that it's anywhere near it yet, but would a Trump presidency or a Bernie Sanders presidency break the mold?
Well, starting off simply from the way they are conducting their business model for campaigning, they're already scaring the daylights out of the oligarchs who basically run this country, because what is the preferred position of a candidate? It's to come in hat in hand to the big contributors, whether it's George Soros or the Koch brothers, and say, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir. Now, Trump, by his own modest account, has more money than God, so he doesn't need that, and the media is giving him free media anyway, and there's a certain type of voter who maybe can't connect the dots to how our rigged economy works, but he knows something's wrong, and when he hears that he's not bowing and scraping to the donor class, he likes it. Now, Bernie Sanders, you can hardly find somebody ideologically more different than Sanders and Trump, but they have also business models that get under the skin of the party establishment. Last I read, he had something like 1.3 million small donors, and the average donation is under $30. That definitely breaks the business model of the notion that if you're a Democrat and you want to become president, first you go to Wall Street, then you go to Dave and Geffen's house in Los Angeles and hold fundraisers. So he's definitely both of them are on their radar screen as being bad medicine. Now, who knows what Trump's foreign policy would be? Because on the one hand, he wants not only waterboarding, but worse than waterboarding, and maybe beheading too, as we heard on ABC News with being interviewed by George Stephanopoulos. To my point. On the other hand, you have a large cabal of people around the Beltway here who really want to mix it up with Russia. Maybe they don't want a war, but they want a Cold War that will start the coffers flowing with money for the military-industrial complex. Now, Trump's the only guy who said, hey, I don't have any trouble with Putin. You know, he's a nice guy. which is kind of strange. I guess it's, you know, people sort of recognizing themselves in others, perhaps. But in any event, at least it's one less headache that we would get into a Cold War with Russia. Now, as for Sanders, everything he stated would suggest that he would be far less hawkish than Hillary. Now, he's been confused or been criticized for simply going back over and over again, almost like Rubio, to saying he voted against the authorization in 2002 to invade Iraq. Well, you know, so did a few other politicians. He probably would do better for himself to say a more dispositive proof of what one would do would be not simply voting as a legislator, as 535 of them did in 2002, but what happens when you have executive authority and you're planning something? And I think we see now with the intervention in Libya, which Secretary Clinton supported, he died, has not turned out very well. Director Clapper of the
DNI, right.
Intelligence community, DNI, basically said this thing is a real problem. Mm-hmm. A real hotbed of potential terrorism. It has left that area far more destabilized than it was prior to 2011.
So let me ask you all, and I'd like you all to obviously talk with each other, because I'm sure you have questions. But just in general, the one thing that struck me about Bernie's victory here in New Hampshire is he's won every demographic group in New Hampshire, according to the New York Times. And I wonder what that augurs for the future. So, but go ahead. Anybody can take it. And
I just wanted to say one thing in response to what Mike said about the structural issues within the parties that both Trump and Sanders pose. I got to say that is the most astute comparison between the Trump and Sanders that I have heard anywhere. There's so many ridiculous and false comparisons made between the two that disregard mm-hmm. the fact that most Americans disagree with positions that Trump has articulated, and most Americans agree with positions that Sanders has articulated. Yet both get thrown in the same box as fringy McFringers, right? So, but this whole idea of how they mess up the parties, I think, is really astute.
Thank you.
Jacob?
Well, it does not augur well for Clinton, but I still think that given her organization, that she will win this nomination against Sanders. And in a way, if you wanted to, you could argue that Sanders is actually a good thing for Clinton. Rather than having a coronation, she is being toughened up in this race. But it is surprising to me how weak she is as a candidate, even more feeble as a politician than I anticipated.
Well, there does appears to be a kind of Groundhog Day with 2008. It seems to be repeating itself. Jedediah, obviously, you don't agree with that or don't want that to be the case. You want Bernie to end up in the White House. But if he doesn't end up in the White House, could he build a national movement?
Well, I think that's exactly the question. It's a very strange year, and the future genuinely is surprising. So while there's lots of grounds for conjecture, we can't know. Certainly lots of indicators give weight to what Jacob says. And if you put a gun to my head and ask me to bet my children's inheritance on the Democratic primary, I hesitate to say what I would do. But I think the real question is this. The real question is whether we should understand the Sanders campaign as a movement candidacy of a kind that we haven't seen loom large and succeed among Democrats for a very long time. And I think the historical analogy here is to the rise of the new right that took over and redefined the Republican Party between Barry Goldwater's loss in 1964 when he was a radioactive candidate, almost literally, and Ronald Reagan's victory in 1980, which turned him into one of the iconic presidents for, you know, so many people, including Barack Obama. Reagan, who was very much a Goldwater Republican. So I think that while this is an exciting year for Sanders supporters, we should regard the campaign as an opening and a chance to build movements, coalitions, a vocabulary, ideological commitments that move the party in this direction that is, it's severely liberal, can we say? It's enthusiastically liberal. It's social democratic. It's about structural equality, and it's about a deepening of democracy and about a fair economy, to put those things front and center and make it clear that we mean them with a level of seriousness and specificity and also radicalism relative to the corporate drift of the Democrats in the last 20 years, I think is something that has force within and also beyond the Sanders campaign. And so while I think it's true tactically that this may be good for Hillary, were she to win, she would have been toughened up. I think we can also hope that it'll be good strategically for the redefinition of who the Democrats are and why you would even be a Democrat.
I guess in terms of a first tonight, this is the first Jewish candidate to win a major party state primary elections for president. I don't.
Just as may I say that the Iowa caucus was the first time a woman won the Iowa caucuses. Thank you.
Well, then we're breaking all kinds of ceilings here. But I don't think that Bernie is particularly advertising his Jewishness.
Well, I did want to say something to what Jedediah just said, which I think is really fascinating, and I hadn't really thought about it in that light. But having been a student of the right and the new right for a long time, the one thing that will be required for the Sanders campaign to form the basis of a new movement that would exist within the Democratic Party in the way that the Goldwater campaign was, is it that it will require building of structures and trying to figure out how, where the resources for that will come from, I think is going to be a really interesting challenge. You know, the right built think tanks and and the National Review and, you know, all of these infrastructure, these infrastructural entities that put forward the ideology that that it's going to be very interesting to see what that formation would look like.
Could I cut in? I'd say that, you know,
Mike Lofgren, go ahead.
We put in so much attention to the primaries and to the presidential election. Most people don't think that Barack Obama is a two-term sitting president, yet we have 31 state governors who are Republicans, a like number of state legislatures. It goes all the way down to the school boards, which are in many respects dominated by evangelicals at the local level in many states. So you have a situation, no matter who wins the presidency, if the institutions are not built, you really have a very thin political party on the ground. I mean, again, as Obama, the two-term sitting president, Republicans have the largest majorities in the House and Senate that they had since about 1930.
And they're going to have the House for a good long while.
And Jacob, were you going to jump in with something?
Well, it was similar. I was going to say, you know, the Democrats are flirting with utter disaster. If they lose the presidential race, the Republican Party, if you look at the Supreme Court's decision today to issue a stay on Obama's plan for coal emissions, you would see a massive rewriting of legislation, of regulatory acts. I mean, the Republican Party would be completely dominant if they win this presidential election.
Yeah, that's if I could quickly, that's
Jedediah.
Right. This is very high risk. But I just want to embrace what Adele has just said. I think that to take this idea of movement building seriously, we need to go beyond the model of what that meant in the Obama campaign, which was really something that had the spirit of a movement but not the structure, and was ultimately very much about the charisma and integrity of the candidate and not about a movement with a program. So we do need to think very much about the model of the new right, and also the earlier model of the progressives, who in the early 20th century built up, spent decades building up the institutions and the ideas that became the basis of the New Deal and really defined an FDR Democrat for what it is now.
Well, you know, so often in American politics, and particularly on the Democratic side, at the end of the day, their best argument seems to be, well, what about the Supreme Court? You know, the other guys are worse than we are. I don't imagine that it's going to be quite that bad this year. But as it happens, that argument carries a lot of weight, doesn't it? There's likely to be three appointees to the Supreme Court, and that will decide America's future in a very profound way for decades to come. So why don't you all comment on that?
Well, to borrow a word from the from two of the candidates on opposing sides, the Supreme Court is huge, man, huge. I'm telling you, huge. I mean, it really is. And of course, and what Jacob just said, you know, thank you, Jacob. I will not sleep tonight because it really is. I mean, when you think about what this court has been able to hold down, you know, hand down with the 5-4 majority that it has right now. You know, thinking about another couple of generations of that, which is what could happen, is really terrifying. I mean, we are sitting on the verge of, you know, public sector unionism could be destroyed with the Friedrichs decision that will be handed down before this, the end of this term. I mean, the definition of what's acceptable to in terms of abortion regulation will be determined. And look at what Citizens United and its spawn have given us. So I do think that, you know, as Jedediah said, this is a high stakes election. It's a big deal. The court is kind of everything when you get right down to it. Despite the fact that Mike, you know, astutely pointed out that, you know, the Republicans, they have the state level power, and the presidency will remain weak as long as they do. But nonetheless, that's a lot of power that the president has in appointing the Supreme Court justices.
But if they get the whole trifecta, they'll have it all, yeah. Right? They'll have all branches, yeah, of government. What kind of an America will that be, Mike Lofgren?
Basically, what we have now is getting close in some states. If you look at Wisconsin or Michigan, it's pretty much a kind of modern oligarchy. And depending on who gets elected, well, it will simply intensify. Or if Trump gets elected, they'll just dispense with the camouflage. This is what seems to be pitching, is something that Republicans often talk about in, you know, coded winks and nudges to rev up their base, only he really means it. So it's no longer kind of fake Democratic system with an oligarchy controlling it. What we will see is a kind of pseudo-populist fascism.
And Jacob, what's your vision of the future here?
I have, if it's Trump, I am more skeptical, because I think he's so fundamentally untrustworthy that he was capable of running against the Republican Party, both in the general election, and he would feel absolutely no loyalty to a Republican Congress either. So I'm not sure where it would head under Trump, especially as, I mean, he's openly disdainful of the idea of cutting entitlements. People in the Wall Street Journal call him at best a Rockefeller Republican. I don't think Trump's a conservative,
the populism. I suspect Trump will pivot in the general election and move actually more towards the middle. I don't believe that he would run as a hardcore conservative. I think he's such an opportunist that.
But it wouldn't be good. Exactly, it wouldn't be good for the Democrats to lose all branches of government and what?
No,
certainly. If you look at
the 1890s or the 1920s.
If you look at his rallies, there's something that really ought to concern people. When anyone protests, they get beaten up, and he stands there with his arms folded and his lips pursed, kind of looking like Mussolini. I mean, we've seen these newsreels before. He may not be following the Republican ideological line as promulgated by the Kochs in terms of laissez-faire, but it would be a kind of one-man rule if he could accomplish it.
And Jedediah, do you have a quick last word here? We're running out of time.
Yes, well, I think indeed that Trump is, in a sense, almost, if I can put it this way, a post-political kind of politician, in the sense that he is not ideological. He seems to be driven by a certain kind of psychological appetite, a kind of massive narcissistic feedback between him and his supporters. He doesn't speak the language of principle, tradition, institution. He speaks a very personal language of resentment, of being tough or weak, of being ripped off or being the one who rips people off. Everything from his talk about the rigged political system to his talk about foreign policy ultimately comes down to that register. So I do find it plausible, as Jacob says, that the narcissism could turn him to the center in the general election because he wants more people to love him and not just this crazy base. But on the other hand, he strikes me as the candidate most likely to engage in extra-institutional, basically proto-fascistic kind of relations with his constituency because he's so outside the norms of what, to use a sort of old-fashioned word, we think of as political decency, and whose forms, at least, even the other conservative Republicans cling to, you know, whatever they do to the substance.
Well, I thank all of you very much for joining us here on this national broadcast on the Pacifica Radio Network, Mike Lofgren, Jacob Harbron, Adele Stan, and Jedediah Purdy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.